Welcome to Pentagon Solutions on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Here's your host, Tom Temin.
For the Defense Information Systems Agency, the insider threat is a matter of national security. For its cybersecurity insider threat chief, Paul DiMonato, it's a matter of making sure policies cover both classified and unclassified networks.
Most of our folks use both, and you set the policies on each network. Some of them are set because if you have some bandwidth limitations and you have resource limitations, and you're working for the government, so you're supposed to be doing government work.
Sure.
Perfect example is when you have like March Madness, and you have all of the basketball games and different things. That typically out in private industry, you see that as a major bandwidth hog as far as live streaming of the games. So in Department of Defense, we have to make sure that we're mindful of the bandwidth considerations, especially for the missions of the warfighters downrange.
And with respect to use of browsing and which sites you go to, that can be, I mean, prohibited sites can be blocked at the network level, correct?
Correct. Typically what we'll do is we'll have a cyber defense tool that basically categorizes the websites. In general, there's web content filtering and web categorization tools out there that basically commercial sites will say whether they're a nonprofit, they're a social media site, they're a communication or news organization, they're a sporting and gaming site, and they're categorized. And then you can basically determine from a company or a government entity organization what sites, what categories you're allowing to your network. So you can say which sites will come in and which sites won't come in. Hackers and different things like that, they'll stand up non-defined sites. So they all show up as uncategorized because they haven't been categorized. And by blocking uncategorized sites right off the bat, you are hardening your web browsers from going to sites that probably have bad intentions.
We're speaking with Paul DiMonato, Cybersecurity Insider Threat Chief at the Defense Information Systems Agency. You mentioned use of word processing software. How is it possible to monitor what types of files people are creating?
Based on the policies that you set in user activity monitoring software, when they open up a clipboard or a Microsoft Word application or an Excel spreadsheet or a PowerPoint, you can set your policies based if they're opening up a classified document and then they're cut and pasting without the classified markings. You can set the policy to say, hey, you have to alert on this, send an event to the analysts that are monitoring the system that this user is cut and paste this application or this data out of a Word document or a clipboard document without the classification markings, and then they printed it off or they saved it off into a file that didn't have any classification markings. It's kind of shows the intent that they're trying to hide something or they're trying to move data without the proper labels and classifications on it. So the tool sets that are out there, some of the commercial products that are out there that capture that user activity monitoring actually let you set those policies.
Can you set those policies for word processing programs that are operated and hosted locally and also in the cloud, say with a product similar to Microsoft 365 or Google Docs?
Yes, as long as you have, if it's in the cloud, you have control of that virtual instance or that organizational instance that you say, I want this monitoring software to be put on it, and I want the monitoring software to report to this analyst or this hub. Just like if it's on your individual box, you'll have an agent on that. It's just your individual system and you point where it reports to for the analyst.
And getting back to the question of phishing, you implied that there are tools available that can filter out a lot of email coming in that looks like phishing. How does all that work, and what about the ones that get through?
So a lot of those, they're called secure mail guards. A lot of them are signature-based. So it basically, a lot of your malware has certain signatures, And as long as it trips on those signatures, it'll take the action that the guard has specified, whether it's blocking, whether it's logging. Typically, most of those are blocked. But if you have some messages come through that have not been seen before and have not triggered by a signature, you can create a new signature and then you can start logging that activity and you can put it into blocking mode.
I imagine you have a lot more latitude in setting higher filtration for classified networks maybe than for unclassified, where you might be getting vendor information and inquiries in from a business standpoint that you wouldn't necessarily expect on a classified sense.
Correct. In the past, when we looked at the classified network, everybody had the mindset of, oh, it's a classified network, it doesn't touch the internet, we're kind of safe. Now we have to start to make sure that we're paying the same amount of attention to the classified network that we have from the unclassified network. But the unclassified network, you have more exposure to threats from a lot of different adversaries. You have a lot of the marketing spam. You have a lot of the different vendors sending you information, trying to get you to buy their products or get you to go to their events and different things like that. So you have a balance.
And when it comes to educating and training users, what are some of the techniques that DISSIT uses for its own users, and what do you recommend for the using agencies that might be using different DISSIT services?
So when a new employee comes to DISSIT, the first thing that they have is they have a newcomer's orientation. And part of their onboarding is they actually have to sign a nice legalese document of probably 10 to 11 pages of what their acceptable use of the government furnished equipment is or their computer system. So during the newcomer's brief, we have one of our incident responders typically will go through portions of the user agreement and make sure that they know what the do's and the don'ts are. And then annually, we have users that have to take computer-based training on basically good cybersecurity practices. Another area that we've recently undertaken is every week we have a basically cyber defender question that pops up on our computer in the morning. And basically it just reinforces the lessons from the newcomer's training or the annual CBT that they have to take. So it's a continuous education feed into the individuals where they ask them questions or sometimes show them a video of proper way to telework and transport your laptop. If you're a system administrator, proper way to use your privilege, use your credentials, some phishing emails. So it might be a video, it might be a question of the day or something along those lines. So we try to do continuous education throughout the lifespan of the employee.
And do you make people explicitly aware that there is an insider threat program in place?
Yes. Separate, we also have an insider threat training that is annual. So we have insider threat questions that actually go in that weekly pool of questions that is given to the users. And then we also have a more in-depth insider threat brief that goes into some of the counterintelligence aspects, some past cases, and where we've seen different things along those lines as far as information that people are trying to get, what some users have done in the past, how you can protect against, and more importantly, some indicators of what might be indicative, might show a employee what they should be on the lookout from their peers. And it's basically what I like to say is insider threat program is only as strong as the people. Insider threat is actually a people problem. And basically, they're my best sensor out there is the peers. If you see any one of the events, they say, oh, yeah, that person always acted that way. I just didn't say anything. Every past case of an insider threat has had something like that. So one of the biggest things is trying to educate the users to say it's okay to report suspicious activity, and these are the things that we want you to look for.
Paul DiMonato is the Cybersecurity Insider Threat Chief at the Defense Information Systems Agency. We'll post the whole interview at federalnewsradio.com/federaldrive. I'm Tom Temin.
Pentagon Solutions will return after these messages.
Join Federal News Radio Executive Editor Jason Miller for Ask the CIO, Thursdays at 10 and 2. Hear from your agency's top tech leaders on how they're using technology to change the way you meet your agency's mission. Ask the CIO is a must-listen for anyone who needs to know federal technology policy, implementation, and planning. Ask the CIO, Thursdays at 10 and 2 on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Download at any time at federalnewsradio.com. Search Ask CIO.
Profile America, Monday, June 19th. The first Chinese student to graduate from an American college was Yang Wing, a naturalized American who received his Bachelor of Arts degree from Yale University in New Haven, Connecticut, this month in 1854. That year, some 16,000 Chinese immigrants arrived in California, though ensuing restrictions greatly reduced the annual arrivals for decades thereafter. Today, there are almost 4 million Americans of Chinese descent, and they are no longer a rarity on college campuses. Over two-thirds of the school-aged Chinese-American population have a college background or are currently enrolled in undergraduate programs or graduate school. 27% of Chinese-American adults have graduate or professional degrees. You can find more facts about America's people, places, and economy from the American Community Survey at census.gov.
Wednesdays at 11 and 2, DoD reporter Jared Serbu hosts On DoD, an illuminating discussion with senior Defense Department managers about how DoD and all the branches meet their mission. From the budget to IT to material to workforce and readiness. On DoD with Jared Serbu, Wednesdays at 11 and 2 on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Download it anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Search On DoD.
You're listening to Pentagon Solutions on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Now here's your host, Tom Temin.
Since 1951, the Defense Advisory Committee on Women in the Services, DACOWITS, the Armed Services, that is, has forwarded its annual research findings to the Defense Secretary. This year, the committee studied 14 areas, and joining me with the highlights and some of the recommendations, retired Air Force General Janet Wolfenbarger, who chaired the committee. General Wolfenbarger, great to have you on.
Thank you so much. I appreciate this opportunity.
And you are fairly new to this committee, correct, after having served as a first four-star in the Air Force and retiring?
First woman four-star in the Air Force, yes. Retired in July of 2015 and came on the committee in March of 2016. I assumed the chair position in June of last year.
And what did you look at for the report just submitted to the Secretary of Defense?
Well, we had 14 different topics that we studied. From those 14 topics, we came up with 14 recommendations, and then we have what we call continuing concerns, so areas that the committee has studied in the past that we want to keep in front of the Secretary of Defense and the department writ large relative to areas that we want them to stay focused on.
Probably in 1951, no one could have imagined that the day would come when every single possible combat role in the military would be open to women, but that's been the case for a couple of years now, so I imagine that must still be a dominant topic for this committee to look at.
Yes, it absolutely is. In fact, Tom, if I could put this in perspective just from my own career, I spent 35 years in the United States Air Force and saw great evolution towards gender integration over the course of those 3.5 decades. It was during my lifetime that I had many positions that were closed to women, gradually open to women, and then ultimately here just after I retired, it was in December of 2015 that the Secretary of Defense issued that direction to open all positions to women, to include those that have been formally closed due to the combat relationship.
And how is that coming?
So there is a process that the Secretary of Defense mandated, which was to ask all of the services to develop implementation plans that he would approve. He did that last year, I believe it was in the March timeframe. And then subsequent to that approval of those individual implementation plans, each of the services have been marching along to their own individual plan. The committee has requested fairly routinely status updates on how those integration implementation plans are executing. In fact, we have a Dakowitz meeting coming up here this week, and we will get another status update from each of the service representatives.
And how are the services doing? I think it varies, doesn't it?
Well, it does. And each of the implementation plans is different, you know, relative to the individual positions for each service that had previously been closed that are now open. I'd say, and now can I tell you, Tom, that I need to kind of caveat that while I am the chair of Dakowitz, I need to note that although any opinion that I express to you this morning is really in my own personal capacity, not on speaking on behalf of the committee. Certainly, I'm happy to share with you the committee work, but opinions are my own. And from my perspective in answering that question, I think the services have all come a long way. They continue to make progress, but this is a culture change, and it will take years, in my opinion, to get after fully integrating throughout all of those previously closed positions.
Because there have been some practical matters that come up. For example, the fitness requirements of men versus women to get through some of the special forces training and even some of the basic training. And also the combat gear, I guess, continues to be a little bit of an issue, probably less so than it was a number of years ago. Gear to accommodate a female body versus a male body and some of the standards along those lines.
That's absolutely true. So those are two different topics that you raised, two topics that, in fact, the committee is focused on. The first you mentioned was the standards. So there are physical fitness standards for each of the services, and then there are occupational standards. The fitness standards do recognize that there is a difference in physiology between men and women, and the intent there is for all the services to assess the health and the readiness of their personnel in terms of physical fitness capabilities. The occupational standards were mandated to be gender neutral by the Secretary of Defense so that anybody that is qualified and can meet those occupational standards should be given afforded the opportunity to participate in that particular career field or that particular role. So those standards have been put in place, and they are now in the process of attracting women to go into those various career fields. And I think it's slow to start. I think most people would say that. That's not unexpected, and continues to progress and accelerate as time unfolds. Now, you mentioned combat gear, and that has been an area of concern as well for the committee. We do believe that the services have made good progress, and in particular, this last 2016 report, we did applaud the services, particularly the Army and the Marine Corps, for the progress that they had made in getting after ensuring that women have properly designed and fitted combat equipment, which is really essential to their readiness.
We're speaking with retired Air Force General Janet Wolfenbarger, chairman of the Defense Advisory Committee on Women in the Services. And what's the committee's sense of the take-up of women that want to go into combat roles? I mean, military careers nowadays are many, many different careers, and really a relatively small proportion of them are frontline combat. And so is this something women in general want to do?
It is certainly now available for women to do. And so we're just in the early stages of understanding what that, I would call it a propensity to say that that is an area that they'd like to go in. One of the areas that the committee has focused on is in what we characterize as, well, within our accessions and marketing, kind of the recruitment activities that we have ongoing, the strategic communications that the services are using as they are attempting to attract both men and women into service. And then in particular, we focus clearly in our committee on those communications, those images that that might attract women. And that was one of our recommendations last year in the 2016 report, was to take a look at the current social media that the services are using, and the imaging that is currently available. And we did a little bit of an accounting to see kind of percentage-wise how many images of women in what we characterize as non-traditional roles were included in that imaging, and came up with a recommendation that we thought there was an opportunity here to increase that positive strategic wording and imaging across all communication platforms.
And probably since the advent of the all-volunteer force, what is it now, 45 years or so ago, increasingly the military life has become a family life situation, and the military has slowly adapted to that. But you also address the specific issue of pregnancy and military life and family life. And what are some of the recommendations there, and how far have things progressed in those terms?
We've made tremendous progress. Again, if I go back to my own personal experiences, Tom, when I first arrived, I was in the first class of women that attended the Air Force Academy. We all arrived in the summer of 1976. So, you know, I spent really 39 years in the Air Force when you count the 4 years at the Academy. And back in the mid-70s, there was still an executive order on the books that allowed the services to separate women who became pregnant or became a parent through another means, adoption, or became a step-parent. So you fast forward to the end of my career and where we are today. Certainly there is now a recognition that that executive order needed to be rescinded, that we needed to embrace the need for maternity leave and now paternity leave as well. Most recently, last year, the Secretary of Defense authorized an extension from what had been a standard of 6 weeks of maternity leave to now 12 weeks, doubling that that maternity leave. That was one of our focus areas during our installation visits this year, was to assess how the service members that we got a chance to talk to felt about that extension and you know, were they taking advantage of it. I think the services have put focus in this area. I think it's an area that continues to need focus. As we look at retention and the fact that in some instances women decide to separate and leave the services at higher rates at various points in their careers, we're focused on the rationale for why. In many cases, it's family issues and concerns. And so some of this kind of circles back to ensuring that we have all the right skill sets and capabilities that each of the services need. And by keeping a focus on the family aspects of serving, it can only help us in that regard.
What will Dakowitz look for in 2017 report? What are some of the issues that are top of mind coming up?
Well, I just had mentioned retention. That is an area that we do want to put a focus on this year. We call it mid-career retention. And as I mentioned, each of the services are slightly different in terms of their experiences to date. But it was an area that we've had the services come in and brief us on in terms of strategies. We've also been out. We do installation visits in Dakowitz, one of the few federal advisory committees that still does getting out and meeting with the various service members. So 55 different visits, focus groups this year, more than 500 service members that we talked to over the course of about a six-week period in the spring. And so we're just distilling the feedback that we received on that topic, as well as the gender integration topic. We talked to service people about their propensity to serve. What was it that attracted them to come into service in the first place? And kind of do they have recommendations for how we could continue to attract high caliber individuals throughout the country to serve? We have a focus on this year on physiological gender differences, and is there a need to take a look at perhaps how that could translate into a different approach in some cases to training to achieve physical standards, occupational standards, fitness standards. We've got a continued focus on maternity leave policy, child care resources, family care plans, those types of things. It's a robust list, I think 12 different topics for this year.
Retired Air Force General Janet Wolfenbarger is chairman of the Defense Advisory Committee on Women in the Services. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you, Tom. I appreciate this opportunity.
Find a link to the report and to this interview at federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive. I'm Tom Temin.
You've been listening to Pentagon Solutions. Download this show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Search Pentagon Solutions.